Welcome to the Government Gurus Podcast, hosted by Alex Bennett. Each episode of The Gurus discusses important concepts such as constitutional principles, philosophical foundations, the structure of the Constitution, and the balance of power between the federal government and state governments. Each episode brings special guests who share their expertise about the important questions we face about our constitutional democracy. This is The Government Gurus.
Dr. Patrick Hickey, PhD, who teaches on presidential, what do you teach on? Presidential power, presidential leadership, presidential?
So the classes I teach are the American presidency, political parties and elections, and introduction to American government. And my research is on the relationship between Congress and the presidency.
And you've been, I know we've talked, you've been published in, was it President's Quarterly, correct?
So my publications appear in Presidential Studies Quarterly, a journal called Congress and the Presidency.
Okay, yeah.
And then I have some book chapters. So one book series I'm involved in that I really like is called The Road to Congress, you know, blank, whatever year it is. So I've been in The Road to Congress 2016 and 2018. And those are sort of more, you know, explaining the dynamics of the congressional elections that year, explaining what happened. And then I also have a book chapter in a book called 42 Inside the Presidency of Bill Clinton book. And one last one in the Oxford Handbook of the American Congress.
Hmm. I knew you were a publisher. I didn't know that many. But it's interesting enough. Patrick and I met in Leesburg getting some food. And I told him I taught political science. And he said, oh, I'm a professor of political science at West Virginia. I'm like, holy moly. So I thought, we need to get you on the podcast. So I contacted you about being on the podcast because your expertise in presidential leadership and power. And we have been talking for a long time about getting you on the podcast. And I'm glad we waited because as COVID-19 the pandemic has spread, the focus in the United States has been on the presidency, the executive branch, and President Trump's response to it. And I thought this is a perfect time to talk about presidential powers in national emergencies, because a lot of my students have been, you know, texting me and asking me questions about what's going on. And I'm not sure for college, I'm not sure. Have you been, I know you were off this semester, but have you had any former students contact you about, like, hey, what's going on? Or
So I've had some emails with current students and former students about, you know, they'll send me articles or different types of things that they think I might be interested in. We just got a student, an internship with Senator Capito's office in, the senator from West Virginia. So we're excited about that. So I've been in contact with students, and, you know, I'm on leave this semester, so I'm not teaching, but, you know, it's a brave new world for the students. And I know I feel really bad for my seniors. Sure you feel really bad for your seniors, that they're not going to get to have that graduation ceremony. That's such a wonderful day for all our seniors.
Yeah. And hopefully they're still, my county is still trying. They're saying we're going to have one. So hopefully that pans out. So, well, okay. So we'll get into it now, but, so the presidency is a very controversial office, and, you know, we're not going to get into the detail of, like, Articles of Confederation failures, but, you know, the new government at the Constitutional Convention, they are creating a presidency, and they're molding it, you know, towards George Washington. But it's not a universal idea of having one man in power. Like, we think it's a normal thing, but it really isn't. So why don't you take us through, Federalist 70 here, and what Alexander Hamilton for the Federalists is arguing with the presidency and having a strong executive.
Yeah. So Federalist 70, the main takeaway from Federalist 70 is that, energy in the executive is a leading characteristic of good government, right? Basically they're trying to make this energetic executive that can respond to crises just like the one we're in now. You know, I sometimes call the president the troubleshooter in chief to my students, right? When unexpected things like 9/11 or the current crisis happen, we look to the president to respond to that. And so part of Federal 70 is arguing against having a dual executive, which would basically have two people who they'd have to agree, right? So basically President Trump and Vice President Pence would both be, you know, they'd be co-presidents and they'd have to agree on anything. Well, the problem with that is it's slower, right? It's really hard to get two people to agree on the right course of action. And so Hamilton's argument in Federal 70 is about, you know, we need just one person to be the president because we need the president to be able to react energetically to crises and problems as they occur. The other part of parts of Federal 70 to be aware of, especially in the context of the Articles of Confederation, which you mentioned, is there's sort of two roots of the American Revolution. One's a desire for representation, right? You know, the Boston Tea Party, no taxation without representation. And the second is a fear of tyranny, right? And a tyrant is someone who uses power to serve themselves and to serve their own goals and to serve, you know, to do what's best for them and not to do what's best for the country. So the founders were really concerned with setting up an executive that would be strong enough and energetic enough to respond to crises while also preventing the potential for tyranny in the executive, in the American presidency.
Yeah, and I'm actually listening to another podcast. What is it? It's called Wicked. I can't remember who produces it. They also produce 1865, and it goes through every presidential election. And what I've seen is that very early on until Harrison, none of the presidents, like, they wouldn't campaign. They just refused. Like, that was like something you let your supporters to go out and do the bidding for you, but it was not proper for, you know, like a gentleman to go out and campaign for this. And that really starts with Washington, and it doesn't change until Van Buren versus Harrison, and where Harrison goes out and, you know, sets up people like, oh, you know, points out to the crowd and says, hey, soldier, I served with you. I think it was Dearborn or Detroit, and you were brave. And, you know, he set the whole thing up, right, to make him look great. And, you know, like, oh, he has a great memory and things because he was attacked. But, yeah, I mean, that's a really good – I like what you said with the two routes, with going with, you know, representation and this desire to protect against tyranny, right? So, and of course we know the anti-federalists are very wary of that proposition, right? They don't like it. But what's interesting to me is that, do you think the American people, do you think they want a strong president? Like someone who maybe goes a little bit beyond the Constitution in a good way, or do you think they're still wary of a tyrannical president?
I think we would like someone who goes beyond the Constitution in a good way. The problem is, you know, we very strongly disagree on who that might be. You know, what most Americans want, I think, is to just not have to think about politics, right? Like, we'd all be preferring to not think about COVID-19 right now, right? The concept in political science, it's NSID. ENSID. So let me remember what that means. Empathetic, non-self-interested decision maker, right? We want someone who cares about us. That's Bill Clinton. Mm. I feel your pain. We want someone who's not self-interested, right? So they're not a tyrant. And we want them to make decisions, like George W. Bush said, you know, I'm the decider. And President Trump has said things along those lines in recent days. You know, he was asked, right, in one of those press conferences, you know, how will you make the decision to open up the country, or how we're going to open the country? And he's pointed to his head. He's like, I'm going to make it up here, make it in my brain. So I think that's what, you know, we would prefer in general for a good leader. So sort of like Plato's Republic. I don't know if your students are familiar with political theory at all, right? But someone who's just virtuous and wants the best for all of us and will just handle all these problems that we don't really want to handle. So that's what we prefer. But then I think the reality becomes, you know, Democrats see what President Trump's doing now and think like, oh gosh, this person's doing that all wrong. And Republicans thought the same of President Obama during his time in office.
Well, and it's fascinating because I had shared an article on social media and it went just completely out of, you know, had to remove it. But the post was how ideology is viewing the COVID crisis, and ideology is dictating how much you believe in the media. And you can even see it with Republican governors in executive and Democratic governors and of states are viewing things completely different. So, I remember it's funny. We look back on the Obama administration and think that when he was trying to get Obamacare through, making people buy health insurance, and people thought, oh my gosh, that was such a horrible thing. And now you're seeing, well, what does President Trump want to do? He's like, I'm going to open this up. And this is like, you can't do that. So, I mean, it stems back from, the convention. It's just like, it's the eye of the beholder, who's in power. And that's the good decision-making. And if you're not in power, then, well, you're doing it wrong, right? That's not the way you are energetic, right? So,
So we call that the perceptual screen in political science. Comes from a book, actually, the University of Michigan, Alex, called The American Voter, which was published in the 1950s. So they call it the perceptual screen. And the basic idea is that Republicans and Democrats can look at the same set of facts and they view it in completely different ways because your partisanship, your party ID, your ideology acts as a perceptual screen, acts as sort of a filter through which you see the information.
Yeah. There's an excellent article. I try to give my kids articles, but it's from the New York Times. And I still get some students that like, hey, wait a minute, this is the New York Times. But I said, forget where it's published. I'm like, look at the study. And that was a study about media bias. And it goes and it takes a look at, who's really biased. And it finds out it's like, it's not the media's fault. It's us. Because we're the ones like, hey, feed me that information. And it was even more like they found it. It was even more in 2016 that if you were a Democrat and heard the name Donald Trump, then you thought the article was less true. And if you're a Republican and heard the name Hillary Clinton, you thought that story was less true, even if that information was correct just by the name. It's like, so it's a very interesting look at the perception. But I forgot. Yeah, The American Voter is an excellent book. All right. So let's go into AP kids. So Article 2 of the Constitution, mm-hmm. right? The president is number 2. And so what powers are outlined in the Constitution for the president?
All right. So I think I have the full list for your students. Okay. The first is the executive power. Right. So Article 2 begins, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States of America. That's sort of the main clause, really. And so the question there is, what's an executive? Right. An executive is really someone who gets things done. So what happens is Article 1, the Congress, writes the laws. Right. But the laws are just words on a piece of paper. And so then Article 2, the presidency and the executive branch bring those words to life. Right. There's a Clean Air Act. Congress passes a law that says, we want to have cleaner air. This is how we're going to get there. These are our standards. And then the president runs the EPA, right, to try to enforce those standards. So that's the first, the executive power. Second is really important here and always important, Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, and also of state militias, which we would now think of as the National Guard if the president decides to call them into service. The third power is the pardon power, or the commutation power, which basically gives the president the power to forgive people's crimes or even commute their sentences, right? So that's when someone would be currently serving their sentence and the president basically says, that's enough, we're letting you go.
That was Blagojevich.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly.
The former governor from Illinois who was trying to sell President Obama.
Yep, precisely. And he pardoned Sheriff Joe Arpaio,
who never even went to trial. It was beforehand, wasn't it?
Well, it was he was convicted, right? So he was
before sentencing.
Precisely. So I don't think he served any time in jail. So fourth is the treaty power. So treaties, right, are agreements between foreign nations. One of the most recent treaties I can recall is the New START treaty that President Obama signed with Russia. And basically, we built up the stockpile of nuclear weapons during the Cold War. And this START treaty, which was under President Reagan, and then the New START treaty under President Obama said, the U.S. will destroy these amount of nuclear weapons in this way as long as Russia does the same on their end. So that's a treaty, right? An agreement between two nations. And that's subject to 2/3 Senate approval.
Yep, that's the supermajority, one of the supermajorities.
So which is be 67 senators now. And so that's a high bar. And then next is the fifth power is the appointment power. So that's appointing judges, ambassadors, and all other officers of the United States of America. So this is cabinet officials, people like that. And so that is subject to just majority Senate approval, right? So that's a little complicated, but now it's basically, it used to be a filibuster. It used to be basically 60 votes to appoint those people in the Senate. But now for Supreme Court judges and everything else, it's basically just a majority.
Yeah, they got part of that nuclear option,
yep.
Right?
Yeah, precisely. And then there's, and we might talk about this later, the power to fill vacancies during a Senate recess. If that were to occur, right, so if there's a vacant, you know, judgeship or a vacant executive seat and the Senate's on recess, that ends at the end of the next Congress, right? So if President Trump were to do that now, that would end basically January 2nd, 2021, because that's when the Congress we're currently in the land. And then finally, sorry, I know I'm going a little long here, but there's legislative powers. So, and these are powers for the president dealing with the Congress. So something the president can do is call Congress into special session. So that's the first legislative power. And basically Congress isn't currently meeting and the president can force Congress to come and meet. So right now, you know, most members of Congress are at their homes, you know, social distancing. Theoretically, the president could compel them to come to D.C. and meet. The second is the State of the Union legislative power. So the president is supposed to give Congress information on the State of the Union, quote, from time to time in the Constitution. So now the president does it annually every year, but the Constitution just says from time to time the president should give the Congress information. Just two more. The president can also recommend necessary and expedient measures to the Congress, say, you know, this needs to be done. We need to protect small businesses during the COVID crisis. You should pass this bill to protect small businesses. And then finally, the veto power, which is actually in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But those are the sort of main constitutional powers that the Constitution outlines for the president.
It seems like, you're listing a lot, and you're like, it seems like a lot, but it actually is not a lot. And we're not going to get into like executive orders and things like that because, you know, that can be another podcast.
Sounds good.
But, so most of those, I mean, I guess the veto power can be controversial. The pardon power commutation where we talked about Blagojevich from Illinois or Sheriff Joe Arpaio from Arizona, there can be questionable pardons. And if you want to look at the list, it's not a Democrat Republican thing. When you can look at the list of pardons and you're like, it's some interesting characters that have been pardoned. So, but what we want to focus on now is, you know, national emergency powers, because I can't remember how many we were technically in. What was it? I think 20 or 30 national emergencies that are still.
Yeah, I think it's about 30.
But most people don't know. But this one, this national emergency here, all 50 states. So take us through the powers the president has, you know, in a national emergency, like where do they come from? And you know, we had a couple I wanted to talk about that are going on now, and then we'll take some, you know, we have some questions from students.
Yeah, so in the 1970s, Congress passes this National Emergency Act. So a national emergency is basically whatever the president says it is. And that had been the case for 200 years before Congress passed this act, right? There's different theories of presidential powers. You know, I'd be happy to go through those sometimes. But basically, you know, presidents as the troubleshooter in chief, as the energetic form of government, the Article 2 and, you know, Federal 70 wanted them to be, have to respond to crises. And so what Congress tried to do in 1970 is provide a process by which the president could declare a national emergency and also a process by which the Congress could check that declaration of national emergency. The irony here, and this is also the irony with the War Powers Act that Congress passed in the 1970s.
Never used
Well, they're very weak checks that almost empowered the president, right? So an emergency, again, is basically whatever the president says. But Congress has this weak check on it. And the weak check is that Congress can terminate the national emergency declaration that the president declared with a joint resolution. So that means both chambers of Congress pass it, signed into law. Mm-hmm. So the president has to sign the bill into law saying that his national emergency is actually not a national emergency, right? Soon her national emergency is not a national emergency. So that's a weak check. So that basically then gives the president veto power, right? And that basically means that two-thirds both chambers of Congress would have to say, no, Mr. President, soon Ms. President, this is actually not a national emergency. And so that actually, you know, this attempt to rein in the president actually really empowers the president. And we could talk about next what it does if you want, or I'll wait for your question.
Oh, no. So, okay. Yeah. So the National Emergency Act. So the powers are, what sort of powers does he, the president, have under this? Like, can he do, like, for example, can he have a national martial law? Can he declare that? Or can he house troops in or house troops in homes if he wanted to?
No, that's it. So the answer to both those questions are no. Right. So martial law, we can talk about later. I know that your student asked about that. That's basically the military taking over the entire government. That's not part of this act. Housing troops in homes is actually called quartering troops. And that's it's the Third Amendment. I know. I thought you were almost going to stump me on an amendment. The Third Amendment says no quartering troops in homes, because that's something that the British did during the Revolutionary War, right? They tried to force citizens or subjects or whatever they were at the time, colonists, to house troops in their homes. So the Constitution says the government cannot force a citizen to house a troop in their home, to give them quarter. Instead, there's so a good resource on this that I consulted is the Brennan Center. That's Brennan.
Yeah.
And they're a think tank that tries to go through these constitutional law issues. So they have a list, you know, if you Google it, just Brennan Center National Emergency Act, they come up with 136 specific emergency powers given to the president under this act.
And
a lot of these are 13 says Congress has to declare a national emergency, but the other 123 at the president's discretion. So that sounds like, oh my gosh, right? Congress gave the president so much power. But this is not really as sweeping as we would think with martial law or something like that. Most of these powers, emergency powers that the president can gain under these acts, have to do with either spending money or relaxing government regulations. So you're able to do things like presidents could say, we're not going to enforce this part of the Clean Air Act because it's a national emergency right now.
Which the president has, President Trump did. And I think President Obama went up to New Jersey, and I mean, one of the things with Chris Christie that ended up probably, I think, hurting him as a Republican nominee, that Barack Obama like said, we're cutting through the red tape and bypassing some of these regulations. And then
with Hurricane Sandy, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, with Hurricane Sandy, and remember the appropriations. The president doesn't have the power to spend money. The appropriations goes to Congress. So it's, you know, when that's a major shift, is that the president has now some authority to spend money where normally he doesn't.
Yeah, precisely. Right. So Article 1, basically Congress has to approve every dollar that the federal government spends. And Article 1 mandates that the House of Representatives start all revenue bills or taxing bills. And that's because the House of Representatives was the only directly elected part of the federal government at the time the Constitution was ratified. And so the idea was, right, that people's representatives would approve any dollars spent by the people. But what President Trump did with the national emergency to build the wall, basically, if you declare this national emergency, you can move money from one purpose that Congress appropriated it for to another purpose that the president now says is necessary due to this emergency.
Yeah. So the two ones I wanted to focus on, like you just mentioned, was declaring a national emergency concerning the southern border of the United States and concerning the coronavirus. Now, many of the students, if you didn't know, the president is taking money from defense spending and moving it over, which he can under national emergency, and he was bypassing Congress because Congress would not appropriate. Oh,
sorry. I am. All right.
Nice. Sorry. Yourself. No.
Sorry, you started with, sorry. I don't know.
I'll put some background music.
No, you started with, for the students who don't know, Trump was taking it, sorry.
Yeah, so President Trump was unable in his first 3 years to get any money towards the border wall, and it wasn't for like a permanent border wall. It was for other things like to reinforce, and even though he will say, hey, I'm building a new wall, he's a lot of reinforcement, but he went around Congress through this national emergency to get what he wanted, and the Congress was not happy, but they really, you know, they're not going to get the Congress to come in a joint resolution with Democrats and Republicans to say no. So that, there you go, that money will still be spent at the border. And then the second one is, now we're declaring a national emergency with the novel coronavirus outbreak, where he's, you know, the president's trying to get testing, this, that, and, you know, they got small business funds, they've got stimulus checks coming out. I haven't got mine yet, but
me either.
So yeah. So that brings us, before we get to the questions, the president said he wants the government open, or he wants business, not, shouldn't say government, excuse me. He wants businesses back open. He wants travel, because this is taking an economic hit, and he's worried that this is going to carry over until November, and it's going to cost him a re-election, right? So he wants to get this economy jump started. But really, what authority does he have when states are quarantining and shutting down businesses? Like Virginia, we have a stay-at-home order until June 10th, right? So what power does he have to do anything against Virginia?
I mean,
he
really has no power there in terms of the National Emergency Act, right? Again, so the National Emergency Act would be relaxing regulations, federal regulations, or moving money to a different purpose. So one thing the president could do, that would probably be a super positive thing, is take some money and put it towards testing, right? You don't have to developing tests. You don't have to wait on Congress to appropriate that money, which it looks like they're doing in this package that's going to sort of re-up the money for the small business loan program, and then probably create, I think there's about $100 billion in there for hospitals and testing, right? So President Trump doesn't have to wait on the Congress to do that during a national emergency, right? Just the same as he's been doing with the wall, which I think has been like $5 billion was the plan or something like that. He could take that money. Yeah. He could take the wall money, right? Take the money you already moved the wall. He could take any money and put that all towards sort of helping us actually reopen in a realistic way, right? And helping us reopen in a way, you know, we're going to need to build masks. We're going to need to build tests. Like, he could do that.
Well, he had that meeting last week or 2 weeks ago with the a lot of the CEOs, and they said, you're not opening unless you get the testing. He's like, it's just not, they're like, Jeff Bezos, and others were like, this ain't happening unless you get the testing done. And that's one of the critical things, is that the lack of testing for so long was problematic. And
yeah, so he could he could do that. He could also ease regulations, right? So like, one sort of scary thing here is like, he could say we could like dump bodies in the ocean or something like that. That's a literal provision of that. That's like a power that he has under this. But then what, to answer your question, sorry to have a rambling answer, but your first question about whether he could force states to reopen, he could not force states to reopen. He could probably force states to close, right? But not to reopen, if that makes sense, right? You can't undeclare, you can't tell the state of New York, no, you actually don't have an emergency here, right? You can probably tell the state of New York, yes, you do have an emergency, and like, these steps need to be taken, but you can probably not tell the state of New York or any other state, no, you don't have an emergency and you must reopen.
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah, like if there's a massive wildfire, and I don't know, like California says, well, what, this is not a national emergency, and the president's like, yeah, it is. And okay, I gotcha. All right, so let's move on to the question period, because we're okay, so I asked students in Twitter some questions. So so President Trump has referred himself to a wartime president on the coronavirus. And we talked about institute martial law, so we've covered that one. So, so what, like the Stafford Act, right? Do you, I put that on there. It's a Stafford Act from, I think, the 1950s.
I think that's right.
Yeah, and so does the president have the power to put like a shelter in place in effect for the whole country? But that just always falls
to
the governors.
So a lot of this, right? So much of the Constitution is brief and vague, especially Article 2 is brief and vague. So people disagree about this. But most experts think the president could not unilaterally issue a national shelter-in-place order. That said, people do think that Congress could pass a law that required Americans to shelter in place for a period of time. But as we just mentioned, right, the Republican Party seems dead set, pun intended, getting back to business as usual as quickly as they can. So what the president can do and what the president has done is use the CDC to offer guidelines, right? So we've all been sort of sheltering, not sheltering in place, but, you know, staying at home, social distancing. And a lot of that comes from the CDC saying that we should do that. And then the president sort of backing that up. A lot of what the Stafford Act deals with is allowing states access to federal funds when states don't have the funds to deal with the current emergency. So the example you just gave, right, if there was a huge wildfire in California and California didn't have the money or the resources to deal with that, the Stafford Act, again, allows the president to move that money to get it to them.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because most of the time when it's like, I mean, we look at Hurricane Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, and was Henry in the one in
Texas?
Oh,
I forget the names, but likely.
What was it? I mean, then when we were kids, we'll date
ourselves. Yeah, Andrew was in Florida. Yep.
States just don't have the resources and capability to, I mean, for even natural disasters to be able to function and to help their citizens. I mean, they've turned to the federal government time and time again to help them because the federal government has the resources and the money for them to access. So, all right. So we talked about his regular powers and but what about, I guess, besides an election consequence, the major criticism is that the President Trump has just not, I wouldn't say lie, but has just given misinformation about many things or her perpetuated things that are just not true, whether he intends to or he's just not trying to panic people. But what it was asked, well, what effects could this have on the public's health? I mean, can this cause a massive problem for
I think that's what's happening right now. If you want my personal opinion, I think the protests that we're seeing across the nation, which the president is at least implicitly supporting with his tweets on Friday and his statement that, you know, they're just good people who are stir crazy. I think that, you know, I think, feel free to edit this out if you like. I think a month from now, we're going to see a lot of stories that someone went to a protest today and died a month from now. Like, I think those are going to be the stories that we see a month from now.
You don't have to wait. I just read it today. Kentucky, this weekend, there's a protest and protesters are now going into the hospital. They've contracted the virus.
What's so dangerous and concerning, because President Trump could stop this with a tweet or a public statement, right? So he tweeted that, you know, liberate Virginia, liberate Minnesota, liberate Michigan. This is all very, it seems very clearly, it's a political strategy. What it seems to me is that President Trump is trying to set this up as, I'm the one who wanted to save the economy, but, you know, these Democratic governors didn't want to. So he's trying to, President Trump's sort of always like an opponent. He plays the media like a fiddle, and the media likes conflict. So he's always trying to have conflict with someone.
Oh, yeah. He knows how to, people complain about what the media, but he just sets them up to, you know, like a yo-yo. They just eat it. They eat it right up. I mean, I think he got $2 billion worth of free advertising in 2016 for campaigns. Like, they just covered him nonstop.
Well, this is how he became the president, right? And he says that too. You know, I'm good for ratings. You know, yada yada. But
he is. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, here I think it's potentially dangerous. Because I do think that I don't think any public health expert thinks that people should be at state capitals protesting without masks on in close proximity to one another.
Yeah, it's not. I mean, that's for another day. But you know, nothing. You know, people worried about their liberties where they're out on a capital with guns and. At least in Michigan, protesting and like, well, it seems like you have some liberty.
A lot, really. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay. All right. So, has there been any Supreme Court case on presidential power that the administration has relied on? Now, I know there's the Youngstown tube where that basically stopped Truman from nationalizing. Industry for the Korean War, but is there any Supreme Court precedent for him besides, I would say, Jacobson versus Massachusetts to say, hey, vaccines in, you know, I think 1907 or 1912. Is there any other case that the president has used, or is it just really?
So, you know, I will be honest here. This is not my area of expertise with the courts. But I think that you are right that Jacobson versus Massachusetts is sort of appears to be the most relevant case at this point. And you know, I would say larger. Yeah, what I do know about courts, and this ties into the conversation we just had about people protesting. You know, we have these freedoms in the Bill of Rights, like the freedom of speech, the freedom of assembly, right? Which is especially freedom of religion. But those first two are especially relevant here. But they're not unchecked. Right, we can't, you know, there's a Supreme Court, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, right? Your speech can't create a public health danger. Yeah. Danger, so we're trying to basically balance the public good with individual rights. And so that's what any Supreme Court case will do. And we know this, especially when it comes to, like, police surveillance, or as we're moving into a brave new world with, you know, how much can the federal government or state governments get your cell phone data, or, you know, email data, or et cetera, all these new electronic forms of communication. That's what is trying to be balanced constantly. And so courts usually sort of side on the public interest side, while also, you know, obviously maintaining reasonable personal freedoms. But I think it would be unlikely. Yeah, I don't know. It's a very open question.
All right. So, very open question with, you know, it's like,
well, I didn't want to answer for 10 more minutes.
Yeah, I mean, that's I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's individual right versus precisely. The common good. And I think people forget that the idea is that the common good, well, usually prevails over individual right. We see that with, like, gun ownership, speech. Those are the two most, I think, infamous, infamous was the word I'm looking for, but ways in which your rights can, as an individual, can be limited if it's causing harm to somebody else. Dr. Hickey, we're 40 minutes in, maybe a little bit less because we chatted a little bit earlier before we started, but if you're going to summarize this, and what if you wanted the kids to know one thing about presidential power, what would it be?
I think it would be that presidential power is as expansive as citizens let it be, right? The real check on presidential power is Congress and the American people saying, no, the president can't do that. And the story of American history is presidents testing the limits of their power. And sometimes that's for good. Right. Sometimes that's for great good. It's as big or as small as we, the people, want it to be.
Well, thank you, Dr. Hickey. I appreciate your time. And are you on?
I'm at Professor Hickey on Twitter.
I should follow you. I always
I should say, so you can see my articles on academia.edu. And then I have a couple pieces that your students might like on a site called The Conversation. So if you Google Patrick T. Hickey, The Conversation, I have a couple pieces meant for like a general audience on President Trump's dealings with Congress. Yeah.
Nice. And hopefully, if our audience doesn't know, Dr. Hickey and I live about 100 yards from each other. So
hopefully I'll see you soon when this is.
Yes, I hope to. I hope to do that as well. It'll be great to see you and your family. All right, you too. Take care.
Yeah, right. Have a good night, buddy. Bye. All right.